You're listening to RevOps FM with Justin Norris. For most of us in B2B, the marketing automation platform, aka MAP, is the anchoring piece of technology in the MarTech stack. When I was first buying a MAP, there were way more options than today, but generally they all bundled a few core features together. They provided a database for your lead and activity data. They provided a way to segment audiences. They send emails. They give you forms and landing pages. And they provide workflow functionality, the ability to execute if this, then that style logic for various things like your scoring, your data management, your pipeline management, and so on. So whether you're using Marketo or Pardot or Eloqua or HubSpot, you're kind of used to thinking of all those functions bundled together. But does it have to be that way? Is there a reason why you need to do your lifecycle processing in the same tool that you send emails with? And of course there isn't, but what does a MarTech stack look like where these roles are distributed differently? Today's guest has answered that question and put it to the test. Niels Foat is Senior Director of Automation Solutions at Tray.io, where he's been for almost 5 years, and he's built a composable stack and documented exactly how it works in a really interesting series of blog posts on the Tray website. And one thing I'll say, Niels, is I've been thinking about these problems for a lot of years, and you really have put something together that I've thought of a few times but hadn't yet seen or done, which is a pure workflow layer that's abstracted from the MAP. And you've done it in a really thoughtful and well-architected way. So I'm really excited to dive into the details with you. Welcome to the show.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Justin. And just want to say a big thank you for having me on the podcast. I did have a chance to listen to your episode on the humans of MarTech this morning, and just really appreciated the level of depth and of insight that you had as you were talking through how we're all thinking about AI. And these are all really interesting technical challenges and speak to me and my technical itch when it comes to working on these kinds of problems. And I think that affinity towards looking at these sorts of technical problems and innovating on technology is kind of what drove me to rethink how we approach the MarTech stack. And anyway, I'm happy to go wherever you want to go and talk through that journey, but this is definitely a privilege to be here. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And why don't we start with just like a quick replay of your journey as a MarTech architect? Because I think all of us make decisions in large part based on our past experiences, what we've seen that's worked and didn't work. So before you came to Tray, what were the sort of tools that you had worked with?
Good question. I actually didn't start super heavily on ops and RevOps until I got to Tray. I was always in and around it and always working closely with ops people, but it was not my primary profession. So I actually came up in the tech space through a user experience agency. So what we would do is this was in the lean startup days. If you're familiar with when the Eric Ries craze was going on, we were working with a lot of high growth startups who needed help with user experience design on either through their product or through their marketing website, going crazy and their needs are constantly evolving. That's the type of work I came up doing. And what I always gravitated towards that is the technical side of it. And so, for example, I would basically be like a product or project manager for a UX engagement. And we would have inevitably some kind of technical piece that needed to be delivered with that. Let's say front end code or a website CMS or something like that. And in the background, what I would be doing is actually, can I help deviate some of that WordPress site? Or can I like figure out how to hack in tag manager here? I would always just find ways to insert myself into the technical side and self-taught myself a lot of that stuff.
I want to give a shout out to the sponsor of today's episode, Knack. You know, I love marketing automation software, but let's be honest, the email and landing page builders are usually terrible. You can't make it nice without a developer, and marketers are going to find a way to break things or go off brand. You do not have time for that. So Knack is totally different. You set the guidelines and then give your users a building experience that's slick, modern, and beautiful. When they're done, everything goes to your map at the push of a button. And don't worry, it supports global teams, approval workflows, it's got your integrations. So head on over to revops.fm/knack, that's K-N-A-K, and get a special offer just for my listeners.
So what I ended up doing was I went in-house to a company called New Relic, basically doing exactly what I was doing in an agency setting and inside New Relic, which was a high-growth dev tools startup. And I got exposed to a lot of interesting technology. So at the time, Segment came along and we were using analytics.js as our data layer, so to speak, for collecting all this clickstream data. And we're like, okay, well, now we got to put it in a data warehouse, right? So we got Redshift, right? And we started putting all that data into Redshift, and they're like, oh crap, now what do we do? We got to get it back out. So we were doing like reverse ETL before reverse ETL was cool, I like to say. And so Redshift, analytics.js, tag manager, those were like where I came up on the data side and just kind of like, how do I pull this all together and use it? And then as I've come into more of an operations role here at Trey, I've gotten exposed to the classic MarTech stack, which when I first got here was Marketo and Salesforce and Outreach and all the sales enablement side, Sales Navigator and Sales OS and all those kinds of enrichment vendors, all of it. I'm familiar with a lot of the traditional sort of MarTech stack and have a really close familiarity with, I would say, like the whole data stack that's been evolving over the last 6 or 7 years.
I could really relate to what you were describing on those projects, like gravitating towards the technical, because I felt very much the same when I first started getting into MarTech more broadly. And I don't know what it is, but there's just something about the, oh, this is cool. Like I could stitch these things together and build something cool. Almost like playing with toys, but not to trivialize it in describing it that way. But there's something very fun about making something work and stitching it together and having an elegant architecture. So there's a certain scrappiness to your approach that you described. And even though you then inherited a conventional stack at Trey, you were starting out, it seems like, a New Relic with a lot of different tools. So it wasn't like this scary undiscovered territory. You were already exposed to, you know, what these alternative paradigms would look like. So you came to Trey, you've got your standard Marketo Salesforce Outreach, which you know, a lot of us can relate to. What were the pain points? Like, what were the challenges that you were experiencing with that design?
Yeah. So when I first came in, my job was actually nothing to do with this, right? So what they actually wanted me to do was a lot of what I was doing in New Relic, which was like, hey, help us stand up a PLG motion, right? We've never had a trial. Like, how do we do that? And help us get our web presence up to snuff and like that sort of stuff. But again, inevitably I found myself gravitating towards those technical challenges. And so I was talking to our CMO one day and he's look, like, we are having all kinds of data reliability problems, right? Whether it's with not understanding what stage our leads are at in the funnel or not being able to attribute all these programs that we're working on, right? We're spending all this money and doing ungodly amounts of paid advertising, events, all the things, right? And I just don't feel like I can trust what this data is telling me. And yeah, we've got all this great tooling, but you still have to be able to orchestrate that tooling and make everything work and make it work consistently in a reliable fashion. And so I think it was like a lot of the classic problems that young marketing teams have and young evolving organizations have, and they just needed help perfecting that. Now, the interesting part was I didn't come into it with a preordained mindset, right? Like I didn't come into it with, okay, well, this is how you solve that problem on Marketo. I just came at it from a more, I don't want to be snobbish about it, but like a first principles like mindset. It was like, okay, well, what are the jobs to be done here? What do we actually need to do? And with that different perspective, I started chipping away at it. And I worked pretty closely with a dyed-in-the-wool Marketo champion who we had employed there, who was also struggling with these problems. Like she too was going, I don't know what's happening when and where, and things are overwriting and I can't seem to quite choreograph things in the way I need it to choreograph. And so we paired together and slowly but surely we started building capabilities. And so a simple first version was email validation. Like it's really simple and silly, but every time we get a new lead, we need to conduct some email validation post-processing, right? And so I built our little service that called Clearbit Risk and Neverbounce and did some basic syntactical validation and a workflow. And I'm like, here, just call this through your Marketo program. It'll tell you if it's good or not. And we started just standing up these little capabilities. And that's how it started.
What I was thinking in some ways as you were talking was like, oh, this is really interesting because like you can solve a lot of those problems with, call it MarTech or map native approaches or architectures. Maybe the way that you're doing it is probably better for various reasons. Like I actually have come around to that conclusion, or at least as a hypothesis, probably too early to say it's a conclusion, but you gravitated naturally. I think it helps that you're working at an iPaaS company. So you have those tools available to you and there's a lot of confidence in the tools, but it is a less conventional approach. And was there anyone or any company out there that you were inspired by, or you really were just, well, like we need to put this nail into this wood, and this looks like a hammer, and I think looks like a good way of doing it. Let's do it that way.
I would say it was probably more the latter. If anything, what I've been was inspired by was actually New Relic. And mostly, I was really exposed to developer mindsets and how you architect systems. At the time, we were real big into service-oriented architectures. And that was, right, break down the monoliths into more narrowly scoped services, which have a very narrow function and purpose. And then by doing that, you can use them more interchangeably. So just that idea was sitting there in my head of, okay, services, right? Narrowly scoped. I can build services on Tray. So I can build a validation service. I can build a MQL service. I can build a routing service. And so all these, again, jobs to be done, I was like, well, yeah, all you need is some inputs, right? And if you don't bloat it up, it'll be real easy to use. And then now they're like little pieces that I can then choreograph. And so that was really a big influence for how I just thought about solving the problem. We just kept chipping away at it, chipping away a little bit more, and to the point where it's, wait a minute, we just looked back and we're doing all this work that was previously done elsewhere here. And man, does it scream. Like, it's like fast, like really fast. Like from the time I see a lead until the time that person's coming in outreach, it's like 45 seconds sometimes, up to no more than 90 seconds. Damn, that's pretty cool. And not only is it screaming fast, but like I can, if anybody ever has any complaint anywhere, like I just go straight to the service and I can see exactly what happened, when and where, and how many times it's happened, and then go back to the process from there. It just really felt elegant and easy to manage.
I love what you said about the developer mindset. And this is coming from an English major who fell into marketing and then somehow fell into technology. But I picked up a lot of that from folks like Sanford Whiteman or Jep.
Yeah.
You also know, who have kind of just modeled a lot of those ways of thinking and things like, you know, don't repeat yourself, or having like loosely coupled services, exactly what you said. So I was kind of used to building those within Marketo, which you can do in a way, like you can modularize things, but it's not built to have the same level of, let's call it like ability to orchestrate in a defined way, or probably the level of logging that you get. Certainly you don't get to see like a full JSON input and output for everything the way you can, I think, in a lot of iPaaS tools. So where you went with it seems really logical to me. And I've kind of had the thought, you know, you're used to doing it one way and you don't go there.
I'm sure there are a lot of fantastic Marketo power users out there, right? You just have to know how to use the tool. But one of the things I would maybe argue is that while things like use cases around lead lifecycle are important and probably a first class challenge for ops teams to solve, they're not the only challenge where automation and a service oriented architecture can be applied. And as you look across, there are use cases in which this core fundamental skill set is applicable, meaning relational systems, data models, service oriented design, understanding business logic, all that kind of stuff. There are many processes which you can apply that to that, once you have that core foundational skill set, make you a much different player in the ops space, right? You can impact many more parts of the business that where they're just not getting the love of those kinds of capabilities. Like a simple example is your community experience, right? So everybody's using a Slack-based community experience now, where you have this ability to have this very interactive experience for your customers. And the capabilities to connect that experience to your RevOps systems or your product systems can create some really cool things, right? So like we have a very interactive Slack community where we built these like various slash commands and things that allow our customers to like check your user score progress, check your education progress, apply a badge so that all your best power users have a special little annotation on their name, right? And everybody knows they're the best one at your tool, right? Or people have a lot of workflows on Tray. So look up a workflow by keyword through slash command, right? Like use AI. It doesn't really matter. What I'm trying to say is there are many places in which this capability can manifest. And when you house it within this really rigid frame of marketing automation, then I think it limits your worldview. We can do a lot more.
I want to zoom out for a second and look at your stack as a whole, Tray obviously being a critical part of it, but What are the other main components of your MarTech stack today?
Like traditional demand gen stuff, right? So we have all the paid social lead sources, right? We have those. We have all your traditional enrichment like vendors, right? So Zoom Info, Clearbit. We have event platforms. We use Zoom for our webinars. We use a little bit of Cvent here and there for some bigger events. We have, of course, Trey, right? Acting as this orchestration layer. We use Iterable. We use them for journey orchestration and all the email campaigns and all that kind of stuff. We use Iterable for that. And then we have SalesOS, Sales Navigator, right? For all the contact sourcing, that kind of stuff. And outreach for sales engagement. Salesforce.
I'm broadly familiar with like kind of the Iterable and Braze's. And in my mind, in this like customer journey engagement type of platforms. But in terms of what parts of what we might think of as Marketo functionality that Iterable is taking over and what parts are in Trey, how would you divide up those kind of duties between the two platforms?
My Iterable is essentially what I call journey orchestration, which is most of your customer facing communications. Usually there's a variety of use cases for that, right? So you might have a nurture journey that you take somebody through once they hit a certain status within your CRM, or at least for us, CRM. You'd have like fulfillment type stuff, right? So you had some piece of content that you need to fulfill, right? And then you need to deliver that. You might have just basic database marketing stuff, right? You have an event coming up. You need to segment your database by a certain group of people, right? Who get those communications out, who webinar operations, follow up. All of the traditional customer facing journeys is happening through Iterable. And then all of the lead processing data management is happening through Trey, meaning, okay, from the moment you capture that lead from any given source, could be your website, could be your chat platform, could be your ad vendor, whatever it is, we ingest that through a Trey workflow. We normalize the data. So we need to then normalize it so that it fits a common data model, apply things like lead source and that kind of stuff. And then we run it through what we call our lead pipeline. And our lead pipeline is the sort of amalgamation of lead processing jobs, right? So the first thing we always do is run it through email validation. Then we run it through a lookup process to see if we have that record in our CRM already. If we don't, we enrich it, create it, lead to account match it, run our attribution process, which is basically just stamping the dates and stuff on the lifecycle objects and putting campaign memberships in place. And we run it through an MQL process. And the MQL process is like, hey, are you an MQL? Yes, you are. Okay, then route it. Right? All that sort of end-to-end journey is happening on Trey. And then there's always the ongoing stuff. Are we constantly making sure we understand where somebody's at in the funnel and progressing them through automation so that we all run our reports and intelligence on how everything's working and where people are standing? That's always up to date.
I'm thinking of MQL and I'm thinking as you're talking, like, all right, there's that initial processing flow and then potentially somebody comes in, they're not at MQL yet. Maybe you have a concept of an MQL threshold, which is based on points or an accumulation of activity. And it made me think about where's that activity layer, like the piece that's tracking you visited these web pages and then maybe, you know, assigning some points to that. Is Iterable responsible for that or do you have a separate event collecting system?
Yeah. So we use analytics.js. You can think of it like Munchkin. So okay. Segment provides analytic.js. So we collect all of our sort of clickstream behavioral data through Segment. And that includes the page view data, the form submit events, all those sorts of things. And so we can essentially listen for those events through Trey, and then we can action upon those events, whether that be for changing data values or trigger orchestrating some kind of like internal action or external action. We can just listen to those events.
Are you streaming those events also into the warehouse or something and simultaneously into Trey?
Yeah. So Segment has a native Redshift pipeline. So they're constantly keeping up our different segment sources. They're collecting all this behavioral data and pushing it into Redshift. And then the data team will have like jobs that sit on top of that to basically amalgamate it. You know, data in its raw form isn't always the most useful. Sometimes you need to aggregate it and create views on top of it to make it more consumable for some system or process.
And it seems in some of these discussions, like once you get into independent event collection and storage, and then making those events accessible to other tools, there's a lot of debate around what's that order of operations look like and potential latency and So you made the decision, obviously, to stream it to both places, which is the one that makes the most sense to my mind. Presumably, you considered at least the option, perhaps, of sending it to Redshift and then pulling from Redshift. What made you not go in that direction? I guess, what were the disadvantages, if you did consider that?
Well, for the most part, most of our needs are met through this event-driven architecture. And we don't have like crazy complex scoring and point systems and those sorts of things. Actually, we tried it and we basically decided it's this sort of like subjective assignment of value that, like, I'm drinking a lot of Chris Walker Kool-Aid these days, where like he has this point of view on your declared intent or high intent, like leads being your most valuable leads. And this idea that like we have this weird subjective view of, oh, well, if you viewed two pages and you like downloaded an ebook, like that makes you qualified. That's the ticket, right? Maybe we're overcomplicating this idea of this whole MQL sort of a stick your finger in the air kind of methodology. And what we really need to do is like optimize for a great experience on your high intent reads, which can be basically done through an event driven system, right? In my opinion. And then there are better ways in which to surface the right people to talk to sales and the experience that you should give them. So in that regard, we're okay with more latency, essentially, is what I'm saying. Like, you don't need this real time scoring, routing kind of thing for the people who are not declaring their intent. And so that's why we're okay with essentially pushing things to the warehouse. And by the way, we're not perfect here. Like, we're still in this process of how do you basically take this first party data set that you have and provide sales with a good subset of people and which to prioritize and use the correct motion with those people, because they're not saying to you, I want to talk to you right now, right here, right now. And so as long as we can get the high value leads through real quick, we're okay with a little bit of latency on the backside.
So those events, it sounds like, are mainly like form fills of specific, like what I would call hand raise forms.
Yep.
And then for iterable, does it sit on top of the warehouse or does it sit on top of CRM from an integration point of view, or a combo of the two?
It mostly CRM, right? So most of the data that we need for segmentation purposes is written to CRM. And then I built a custom sync between, because they don't offer an out-of-the-box Salesforce integration. So I built a custom sync on Tray to basically push that data between them. And then we have a handful of custom events that basically act like program member triggers. So like anytime we apply a campaign membership to a person in Salesforce, we listen for that through Tray, and then we emit an iterable event, which gives you program membership triggers. Like, that's the campaign membership triggering process.
Let's talk about integrations a little bit, because one of the pieces that you focused on a lot in your blog post series was moving away from native integrations and using Tray as this primary integration hub. And I was curious what the benefits of this are from your point of view. We all have seen some limitations to native integrations on the plus side, like they are a lot more out of box, and presumably there are a lot of things like error handling and that sort of logic kind of built into some of these integrations, at least ostensibly, that otherwise you have to roll your own, which can be daunting for some people. What influenced that decision as you were building this out?
It mostly came from necessity, right? So we had a belief that best in breed tooling is how we want to go. We have a belief that we can own our own process in a way and make it work in a way that we want to work by taking this approach. But the truth is, you do have a connectivity issue at that challenge, right? Just like we were saying with Iterable a minute ago, like, they don't offer a native Salesforce integration. So that's a problem that we have to solve. So I'm not against native integration by any means, right? If it's going to do the job that it needs to do and save me the cost of ownership, please, I will take it, because we have the capacity to look at these problems a little bit differently. I don't have to put up with the shortcomings of those integrations. And so that's what generally drives it. Sure, we could use that, but then we compromise that last 10 to 15% where it's fallen short, right? And so rather than build around those problems and, you know, try to explain those problems to somebody who just doesn't get it, right? Like, we just simply have decided that we don't have to do that. And 9 times out of 10, it's not this crazy complex integration problem. It's usually just a few small things that are causing it to be non-ideal, right? And when you have those hard skills around, well, okay, I understand webhooks. I understand APIs. I understand basic data mapping and transformations. You could actually close those gaps really easy. You just have to have those hard skills to be able to do it. So it's just come out of, okay, we have those hard skills. We know what the gaps we need to close. Let's just close them and move on.
One of the experiences I've had building kind of a native integration equivalent process in an iPaaS was with Trey. It was a different one, but similar sort of logic and workflows. It's definitely achievable, was my observation. You're a lot more experienced than me in this domain. But you quickly realize, like, some of the things that you take for granted, for example, like preventing infinity loops, where you have something like this recipe or this workflow triggers off an update in this system and makes it up, that makes an update, but then this workflow triggers off an update in this system, and then they start ping-ponging. And so then now I have to solve that problem. And you're like, oh, but what if something is updated in both places at the same time? Now I have to do like field level comparison and resolve conflicts and just things that you don't really realize are happening under the hood in a normal integration. When you actually have to go and build it out, you kind of appreciate, oh, this is doing a lot for me. How have you thought about solving those things within your architecture, or have you built it out in such a way that you could sidestep some of those problems?
Yeah, there's not an easy answer. So first of all, I would argue that those problems you're articulating are actually probably happening already in your native integrations, and you probably don't realize it, or at least you only hear about it episodically, and a lot of things are black boxy, so to speak. So just because a native integration does solve some of those problems doesn't mean they've solved all the problems and it's perfect, right? These are all highly relational systems. And the more things that are interfacing with those systems, be it native integrations or custom integrations or whatever it is, there is this ping pong effect happening to one extent or another. So I almost certainly everybody's dealing with this problem. It's just more that you're less aware of it when you're not on the front lines dealing with it.
So we're all just sitting with our head in the sand, blissfully unaware of all these issues.
Or aware, not having much bliss at all.
Probably, yeah, or the opposite of blissfully, painfully unaware.
What I would argue is like when you own some of this and you literally have the process level visibility, when somebody goes, hey, I see this problem. Why did I get this late? You go specifically to the metal where you see exactly where it happened, exactly when it happened, and you can point to that specific situation, then you can solve it. Otherwise, you're beholden to the level of observability that you have on that system. So I'd rather at least know where my problems lie and that I can fix them than not know.
Do you believe in keeping a kind of intermediary source of truth between two integrated systems, so that like you kind of dump changes from one system in here and then dump the other ones, and then you kind of have this neutral place where you can sort them out? Or have you found that just like two point-to-point integrations, you're able to build the logic in such a way that works an acceptable amount of the time? I'm going to use the Marketo integration as an example, but my understanding of how it works is it's taking all the changes from the Marketo side during any particular sync interval, and then taking all the changes from the Salesforce side, and then it's comparing them. Because if you just sync from point to point, it's kind of like blind. It's, I have this, I go over there, and you have this, and you go over here. And there's other systems out there that I've seen that less pure iPaaS systems, but maybe like Syncree, for example, that maintains this sort of independent, neutral data store in the middle for integration purposes, which I think makes sense. Like, it does answer a lot of those challenges. Or you could just use a Snowflake database or a Redshift database of your own in the middle.
I'm sure there are circumstances where the level of complexity between two systems like MAP and CRM, the sort of throughput, let's say going through those two systems, is sufficient that you need a much more sophisticated layer of triaging conflict and resolving some of the issues that you've articulated. But in our particular case, it hasn't become a big enough of a problem and that we've needed to resolve those conflicts. And that's not to say that means it's not a perfectly valid challenge that people have, right? I think is given that we are able to kind of standard on Salesforce as our source of truth and move out from there, we've not hit some of those traditional snags.
That makes perfect sense. I want to dive back into your lead processing workflow, and you've given a high-level overview of how it works so far. Most people, as we've talked about, handle those functions in the map. And in like my Marketo instance right now, I have a lot of those services that you described built out, but they're just like little brown program icons, like enrichment, MQL, scoring. It works pretty well. I can orchestrate them. Our needs are not like hugely complex at this stage. But you've moved all those functions into Tray. You don't need to convince me of the benefit of doing that because I've seen the power that having a dedicated workflow layer brings. But from your point of view, what are you gaining from going there that you couldn't have just built into Marketo perhaps?
Probably a few things. Like I gain confidence. I feel very confident using Tray, right? And I can like absolutely tell you two decimal places how often any one of those processes ever go awry. I get notified if anything's going wrong instantly, basically. So to me, having that level of comfort and confidence to know exactly what happens when and where to go to fix it is huge for me, just from a pure nuts and bolts ops perspective. I'd say the other thing, if I just kind of take a step back and think about us as an organization, we have a lot of leverage in our MarTech stack, right? Because I have such an ability to evolve my process quite easily, I don't have to have as much technology in our stack. I have a lot of leverage in vendor conversations, right? Because it's a job to be done, which is the process orchestrates. And if I find that one vendor happens to be better than the other, I'm not constrained by all these more rigid connections between those systems. So that ability to have leverage and flexibility in how we approach our technology stack is quite nice. And the other thing that we gain is speed, right? I mean, this thing is just fast, right? And I love knowing exactly how long something takes. And if I need to deal with a huge amount of throughput, suddenly I can do that and it's not a problem. We can do it really fast. So I'd say those are some of the main things.
Make me jealous while you're talking because I don't have what I would consider a really robust workflow tool right now. We have Zapier, but it's certainly not as powerful, let's say, as some of the other options that I've used in the past or for Tray. And the freedom that it brings to know when this thing happens over here, that I can go over here and update this data value. And there's this power and control, as you're saying, that you have. It's so liberating. That's one of the reasons why I really fell in love with that category for what it can do. People that don't have that, I think, don't know what they're missing, at number one. But it also made me curious, as you were describing what you can do. You, I'm assuming, have a fairly unmetered version of Tray. And you mentioned at one point, I remember when you first brought this up in conversation, this design of your stack, there's cost savings involved. From a real world economic perspective, you know, if I was to become a Tray customer, and how do the economics shake out? Because different vendors price in different ways, some price per task, some price per workflow. Am I saving money at the end of the day, do you think? Or am I going to be forced to constrain myself in a different way?
So we're a consumption model, meaning we bill off of tasks. We don't believe that a workflow-based model is the right mentality because it doesn't fit with our philosophy that you want this service-oriented architecture, right? Like you want to be able to build a process, whether or not that process runs a couple times a day or a million times an hour. You should build a smart architecture that handles your processes in the most efficient and manageable way possible. And we think that when you put like billable constraints on things like workflows, essentially people don't solve problems. So we want to tie the consumption of the platform to the cost. I do think that there's true savings that you can have because I don't own a Lean Data. I don't own a Marketo. I don't own a lot of tools that you may have to pay a lot of money for. So what that exact number is, I don't want to pretend that I can give everybody a really clean answer on it. And you do have cost of ownership with this model, to your point, right? Where you're building certain things. So to me, I do think there are cost savings in there, but probably the better mindset to have about it is the level of flexibility and capabilities that you're able to bring to your organization and solve like problems in a much faster and efficient way. So you don't have to have this straitjacket around you where you're trying to operate within the constraints of that straitjacket. Like I can build my stack in the way I need to build it and make it work the way I need it to work, which allows me to help our organization facilitate rapid change faster. We're all talking about AI. How are we going to get AI into our process? And we're worried about governance, and we're worried about security, and we're worried about how do we use our first party data and these models and all this kind of stuff, right? Well, I would argue that when you have a capability like this to build your processes in a way, then you can take new capabilities like AI and you can bring them into your process much more easily. And so to me, indexing on that agility and the ability to do what you have your stack do, what you need it to do for your organization is just as important as saving, you know, five figures on your vendors this quarter.
You mentioned the Humans of Martech podcast, and my friends Phil and John over there, they've talked a lot in some of their episodes about composability and creating a composable CDP. And it's one of those words that's very much in vogue right now. Were you thinking about composability when you were designing this? Or do you see your stack as falling under this label? Or so happened that you've approached it in that way?
It's absolutely a composable stack. If it doesn't meet the definition, then I'm not sure what does. The whole idea is that you can take these core services or jobs to be done and orchestrate and use them in the way that you need to. This idea of abstraction, it's nothing new per se. We were talking at the start of the call about analytics.js or Segment, right? Like they came in with an abstraction layer to instrumentation so that we can move event data to either point solutions or your data warehouse quite easily and not have to go through that process for every new tool we bring into the stack. This idea of abstraction has been going on for quite a while. And to me, what we're now getting into is, so you kind of have like this initial sort of data layer abstraction happening, and you have in the sort of cloud data warehouse, right, consuming that and acting like its own abstraction layer. Your workflow version of this is just another version of abstraction and composability, right? Where now you're creating these capabilities that can be just like those other tools. It can be used in a fashion that gives you the flexibility to decide when and how they're used.
It seems that there is an increasing trend towards companies designing these sorts of point tools and microservices, and they all kind of come up in that way. And at the same time, though, there is an increasing economic pressure in the marketplace for companies to consolidate functionality. And I think we see this in a lot of the sales engagement space, where we have the Gong and the Sales Loft and, you know, various tools like that starting to try to eat each other's lunch from various angles and acquiring tools and bringing them together. And there's reasons that it's easier for budgetary purposes for companies to do that. Or you have the HubSpot is maybe the perfect example where they're like, we'll just build one of everything. We're just going to build it and it's all going to be one huge monolithic stack. Do you see both of these models coexisting? Do you see the future as one and where there's just like this endless diversity of point services and then orchestration tools that bring them all in these wonderful ways? What does the future look like from your point of view?
I don't think it's a endless sort of amalgamation of point services. At some point, there is going to be some benefits to taking certain more, let's call it more broad platforms and leveraging whatever capabilities those platforms have, if it makes a lot of sense for your business and it does what it needs to do and there's less overhead for you, right? And running that model, then run that model. That is okay. There's nothing wrong with using a really smart set of tools to do the core jobs to be done that need to be done. Like, we don't need to just for the sake of composability, right? To develop a composable stack. That's definitely not the mindset I would take. I think it's just more so that having the ability within your four walls of your organization to cross that line when you need to is a capability that we should be prioritizing for our ops functions. Meaning this is a critical skill set for operations teams to have within their house so that when that platform doesn't do what you need it to do, you can make the changes that you need to make and are not beholden to the constraints of that system. And that is where you use it, right? And that's an always evolving thing. Our stacks are constantly evolving. The vendors of today are going to get beat by the vendors of tomorrow, right? And we want the ability to be able to move with that change. And so in order to do that, you have to have these competencies in-house because otherwise you don't control your destiny.
So speaking of the ever-evolving state of things, what are the to-do list that you're like, yeah, I got to fix that someday? Are there still some rough edges here and there?
One of the harder things is what we've been talking about is like, how do we make sure that we can continue to run this practice? So one of the harder things is just teaching people the hard skills, right? Like I've learned that there's a certain profile of operator I need to have underneath our roof who has the right sort of skill sets to be able to run this sort of practice. So early on, for example, I was probably not looking at the right types of individuals with the right types of skill sets because it is a more technical challenge. Whereas maybe you may have brought in more junior practitioners, for example, as part of an ops function. You can't execute this model with a junior practitioner who doesn't have a good systems architecture mindset. So that's been a challenge that I've learned, just like how do you find the right skill sets to run the approach? And then as far as areas for evolving the system, I don't have this major thing that stands out where it's just, oh, we absolutely have to fix, I don't know, our lead scoring approach or something like that. I've been running it for probably 3.5 years now. And so it's pretty mature. So what we're actually more so thinking about is what is next in our inside of our house of capabilities. And so we're doing the trendy stuff right now. Like, how do we actually understand where we can apply AI inside of our organization to do like the things you guys were talking about on humans and MarTech? Like, how do we take less structured data and what are the technical underpinnings that we need to have in place to be able to consume that and make it operationally useful for our organization? What kind of skill sets and services do we need to have in place to do that in a way that security is also going to be like, that's cool, you're allowed to do that. And it's also useful and functional for the business. So one thing we've been doing right now is building a service around all of our sort of knowledge content of how we consume that, put it into a vector database, create a service that we can then use with our knowledge content, and then use that for both internal enablement use cases and customer facing use cases.
ChatGPT that's trained on your own docs or your own data.
Yeah.
Kind of scenario. Maybe last question I'll ask is, in terms of the evolution of this and how you evolve it day to day, what's your relationship to your business stakeholders? Is it you coming up with ideas or presenting them? Are they coming to you with requests? Is it more of a product management style? How do you triage and roadmap these things?
Pretty much like any classic ops team, right? So like I am a business partner to other parts of the organization. I report to our CMO. And so a lot of what we're doing right now is just ensuring that we're facilitating the go-to-market strategy that he's laid out for the organization. And we were in, as an organization, a bit of a transformational period where we're shifting our go-to-market strategy a fair amount, which requires that you got to reevaluate all the things that were tied to the old go-to-market strategy. And so just like any other ops team, like we'll hear the challenges that he is putting forth for us to change. And then we create a roadmap and we prioritize that. We work with our same thing with our sales leaders, right? When a go-to-market strategy evolves, sales organization evolves. You get things like new territories and new segmentations of your customer base and all that sort of stuff. I don't think we're doing anything all that revolutionary there. We just have to be tied to what the business is trying to do and creating a set of priorities, determining what we can do easy and is impactful and making those changes as quickly as we can.
Well, they're lucky to have you. And I love how you think about this stuff. It sounds like in many ways you've built something really awesome. So I'm glad that we could just talk about it and expose more people to the way that you've thought about your stack. I will include links to your blog post series in the show notes because you go into really high level of detail on what you've done. You have videos. If you're listening to all this, to those of you out there and thinking like, oh, I just really should really see and understand more what Niels is talking about, you can because he's gone over it with screen share. So we'll share all that. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a ton of fun learning about this.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hey everyone, I want to invite you over to the RevOps FM Substack community, where you can sign up to get rough transcripts, show notes, longer form articles, and other bonus content. Just head over to revops.fm/subscribe to get free access. I'd also love to know what you thought of the episode and to hear suggestions for topics you want to learn about. Feel free to leave a comment on Substack or send me an email at just